You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Following the end of the Vietnam War, thousands of Hmong refugees resettled in the United States, many making their way to California's Central Valley. Fresno and Sacramento are home to the largest Hmong populations in the United States, only behind Minneapolis. The San Joaquin Valley's agricultural landscape became the roots of a new life for many refugees. Farming provided a bountiful resource of nourishment, community, and also reconnecting with family ancestry. But the personal stories of Hmong refugees have long been overlooked by outsiders, as well as confined and protected by language. A journalist spent 7 years in rice fields, intimately learning the story of one radiant Hmong woman and how growing her ancestors' rice in the San Joaquin Valley led to newfound power. That intimate relationship, along with care and years of research, transformed into a literary portrait. Lisa M. Hamilton is a journalist and author of the new book, The Hungry Season, A Journey of War, Love, and Survival. Lisa joins us now. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Thanks for having me here, Vicky.
I want to start with you first and foremost. For more than two decades, you have documented agriculture as well as rural communities around the world. What drew you to this?
Well, I guess back when I was in college, I was an environmentalist, but my only concepts of environmentalism were abstract, saving places I had never been, thinking about species I had never seen. When I was introduced to farming and the college where I went up in Washington, they had a great progressive farming program. I met some farmers, and they introduced me to the idea of the sort of tangible environmentalism of agriculture. And since then, I've been doing it.
And how did that intersect with journalism and writing?
Well, you know, I joke that I have never been able to get up early enough to be a farmer. Frankly, I've seen firsthand how hard farmers work. And I think I've found for my own self, my skills lie less in agriculture itself and more in words. And so that's where I've put my efforts.
What drew you to Hmong farmers in the San Joaquin Valley outside of Fresno?
Well, the truth is I began this project back around 2014, and my original intention was to write a book about rice and specifically about plant genetic resources, so essentially seeds. I was looking all over the world for a story to tell about rice, though to embody those ideas about resilience within agriculture that plant genetic resources bring. I never thought to look for a really intimate human story related to rice here in California until a farmer friend of mine told me he saw rice growing in a community garden in Fresno. And, you know, being the journalist that I am, I found the person who was growing it. She was a Hmong woman, and she explained to me the significance of this rice they were growing. They weren't growing just anything. They were growing Hmong rice. I proceeded to meet as many other Hmong women who were farming rice in the Fresno area as I could. Turns out there were a lot of them growing on very small scales on sort of scraps of land that in a lot of cases nobody else wanted. It turned out, I would find out over years, that this is happening almost wherever there are Hmong populations in Georgia, Arkansas, Oklahoma. And along the way, eventually, I met Ia. And as soon as I did, the book shifted from being about rice to being about this extraordinary woman.
Yeah. You begin the book with this immersive narrative centering on rice and a rice field and the power that it wields well beyond from just feeding us as being a source of food. What inspired this to start the book in this way?
Well, the idea of starting the book this way was sort of coming into the farm almost as you would see it from the road driving by. So many of us here in California, and particularly in the Valley, have the experience of driving down a road, seeing a farm, maybe seeing a farmer in that field, usually not, and then just driving on, knowing nothing about it, regardless of the fact that that's the food that feeds us. And so my intention was to bring the reader in off the road into that farm, into the rice itself. And there's a sort of image of the rice parting, and there is the woman who's actually growing it. And in those first few pages, we meet her just a bit and begin to understand that this book is really about change, the changes that have taken place in her life, going from losing everything that she loved to really building a new place for herself in the world, beginning in the refugee camps in Thailand and then continuing here in Fresno.
And being in those fields, when what struck me and touched me is when she looks up at the sky, you know, she's reconnected to that history, that ancestry, that heritage, and growing rice just as her ancestors did.
Yeah, without a doubt, there is for Ia, and I think for a lot of Hmong women who are growing rice here in California, the act of growing rice is far more than putting a seed in the ground and collecting a grain at the end of the season. There's a real connection back to practices that have been in place for centuries, if not arguably millennia. And for Ia, I know as she described it to me, it also really connects her back not just to rice, but to all that she's lost, and particularly to her parents.
Would you like to read a part of the first pages of your book?
Sure. I'll read a passage from the prologue. It's sort of where the book begins. And it again, introduces us to this idea of changing and really writing her own story after the loss coming out of the American-sponsored war in Laos, but also violence within her family and a sort of institutionalized betrayal within her community against her as a woman. So I would read the whole prologue if we had 2 hours here, but I'll just read a portion, and it begins where we're talking a little bit about the the difference between her body now and her body when she was a child. Back then, her name was Ai. Her birth name had been Yer, meaning something like precious youngest daughter, but that didn't last. She was a sickly infant, failing to grow, and so people began calling her by the generic nickname May Ai, small one. It stuck. As she grew into a child and then an adolescent, people dropped the first half and called her just Ai, small. Now she calls herself fat, fat like an emperor. She is still only 4'8", but her belly is a pumpkin inside her elasticized pants. Her cheeks are round and full, and under her chin is a crease so deep the center is pale white, like a second smile. Under the crease, a gold pendant with rubies in the shape of a heart, a matching gold watch on her wrist. Today, a hip sack is clipped in the narrows above her waist. The money bag attached to it, tense with a roll of bills, hangs down over her bulge. Her name has changed, too, though she's not exactly sure when. Definitely after the Thai military police collected her on the banks of the Mekong River, still damp from her desperate escape out of Laos. Maybe it was during the fingerprinting when they asked for her name and her husband answered for her. Or later, when that Thai script was turned into English. Perhaps some aid worker with a pen deciding that what sounded like I couldn't possibly be a person's name, so adding a letter to produce the closest thing that made sense. Ia. In her language, E-I-A-B, meaning bitterness, a common name for girls. It was the third time she had been named, but the first time she had been written down on paper, made official. The name stuck. It would follow her through 15 years in the refugee camps, then across the Pacific Ocean to California. It would be the name printed on her United States passport, surrounded by words she could not read and set against a drawing of an eagle and a sheaf of wheat. Ia Mua. With it, a new chapter of her story began. She knew it would never be possible for her to go back and undo the beginning of that story. Once a person becomes an orphan, she can never not be one again. But there was no law that said she couldn't be the one to compose the rest of the narrative. And perhaps in doing so, she could imagine herself into something bigger than an orphan, something more valuable, something less alone.
And that is beautiful. I was going to talk about the name changes in the first decades of Iya's life, but you illustrate that so well in your prologue. I think it also illustrates and really underscores the challenge that you had. I mean, this is just a page and a half. It is so telling of one woman, but you also had to overcome language barriers. The two of you could not communicate. You needed a translator. How did you accomplish this over the 7 years that you were putting this book together?
Yeah. Well, the short answer is that, of course, Iya speaks Hmong and I speak English. And so for every communication of words, we relied on an interpreter. One interpreter in particular, her name is Lore Zhang, and she is an absolute wizard, not just at translating words from one language to another, but really acting as a sort of cultural interpreter and also a sort of a medium for emotion and intimacy. She is an extraordinary person, and I think Iya and I both are so grateful for her building a bridge between us. But you're right, it was an extraordinary extra layer of work to the project. And frankly, it's why I think by and large reporters don't do this. It's a matter of an incredible extra amount of time, but it's also resources. Mm-hmm. I was very lucky to have a handful of foundations support the work, so I could actually pay Lore for 5 years in the field with Iya. But essentially, what we did was Lore and I would go to the farm, and Iya would work, and I would work alongside her, and Lore would walk along with us with a recorder, and we would work and talk, and this went on for 5 years. And what took place was, I think, far different from what any of us would have anticipated from the start. You know, we started out with sort of polite conversation, and through an interpreter, it can be a little bit awkward. But over time, what happened was we were, when we developed a really deep friendship, and we talked about really some of the most intimate details of Iya's life, and I think really went on a kind of a healing journey all together.
Yeah. I read parts where, you know, there were times you guys were sick together. You slept alongside of each other. I mean, you were tied together in a wonderful way for years. Meaning can also be lost in translation. I mean, there's a lot of words that don't exist from one language to another. How did you overcome this to really get to the core meaning of what Iya was telling you?
It's a great question, because you're right. There is a sort of top layer of interpretation that is just bringing my words into Hmong, Iya's words into English, and you can stop at that. But we didn't. To this day, I'm grateful to Iya for sharing her life with me, sharing her story in a way that, in some ways, she never had before. And I felt an enormous responsibility then to honor that trust by bringing, the most rigorous standards to my reporting. And I implemented what I've come to think of as layers of listening, although at the time I was sort of just trying to find a way to understand her words as clearly as possible so that I could write them without interpretation. And so there was that first layer of us in the field, Lore interpreting between us. I would record the conversations and then take them back to my office, read them through, read the English language transcriptions. And then I would go back with Lore on the phone now and have her simultaneously interpret portions of the conversations so that I could understand them more clearly. She might explain parts of it to me. She might find new information. I would also take portions of the transcripts and bring them to a separate translator who would translate them on paper. And often new meanings were uncovered in that way. And so we went through these layers with each conversation. And then I would go back to the farm and we would have a new conversation or have the same kind of conversation again with new insight. And you can imagine over the course of 5 years, particularly talking about some of the most difficult and the most important parts that are written in the book, we would talk about a single sort of instance in her life 10 or 15 times, often with new information coming out, new information revealed or new perspectives on it. And so it made for a very slow and deep understanding of this life that was being shared with me.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with journalist and author Lisa M. Hamilton about her new book, The Hungry Season, A Journey of War, Love, and Survival. As someone who is not Hmong, but telling the story of a Hmong woman, did you initially feel comfortable telling Ia's story?
Well, it's something that I have thought about a great deal over time and still think about. My initial response to that was to simply approach my presence with Ia on her farm, in her world, with her family or with her friends, to just come as a visitor. I would leave myself at the door, so to speak, leave it in my car at the farm, and just listen. And I think for me that is an essential first step in reporting really about anyone, but especially someone whose experience is different from your own, to do far, far more listening than talking. And so that was always my practice. You know, there is a lot of conversation about this in journalism and in, you know, in the larger sense of media these days about representation. And my own feeling is that having a different experience from someone doesn't disqualify you from representing that person, from writing about that person, making a film about that person, what have you. I think, though, that it's the onus is on the reporter to recognize that distance and to do the work of bridging that distance, whether it is through high quality interpreting or lots and lots of background research or just, again, changing one's position to be one of reception, learning, and really visiting rather than coming to it with your own idea that you're sort of slapping on top of someone else.
Because Ia opened up to you like the deep corners of her being and her life, despite a language barrier. Mm-hmm. I could understand for some people, you might not trust someone if you don't share their culture or their language when you're being as vulnerable as that. Why do you think Ia trusted you so much and wanted you to tell her story?
Well, it's a good question. And really, I think Ia is the only one who can answer that. I would not speak for her in this regard. I will say that the first day that I met Ia, Laura and I had actually gone out to a farm in southwest Fresno to meet another farmer who was growing rice, who was neighbors with Ia. And at lunch, we went into the shed to just get some shade and eat some food. And this neighbor, who was Ia, you know, insisted that we come and eat lunch with her. And she was just so excited to have us try different food, to tell us stories, to hear us laugh. She had me try a drink that I had never had before and sort of laughed the whole time that I was, because it was really unusual. It was the water that is that you soak rice in, that you pour off of rice before you cook it. And she had prepared it in such a way that was a beverage that she and her husband loved. And she had me try it. And she was sort of watching me the whole time and you know, having a great time of watching this, you know, this non-Hmong woman experience something new. But after the lunch, she pulled Laura aside and she said, you know, if you guys ever want to come talk to me, I've got some stories to tell. And it was the first of any in all of my interactions with Hmong farmers who are growing rice in Fresno. This is the first time that someone had said, I really want to talk to you. Other people had been really polite and in some cases really welcoming. I totally respect not wanting me to come to the farm for whatever reason. But Ia was the first person who really like reached out her arm and said, come talk to me. I have things to say, and my sense, and I think Ia would agree with me on this, although I'd like to ask her again. My sense is that she had things that she really wanted to say, and that she didn't have people in her life who were willing to listen. And I think in that sense, she saw an opportunity in Laura and me to talk about the really, really special person that is inside of her that I think she knows is inside of her, but maybe hadn't gotten the recognition that it really deserves.
We only have 30 seconds left. An important piece to this is that Ia cannot read the book. You have a language barrier, but you're looking to find a solution to that and translating it into Hmong, both in print and in audio. Where are you in that process?
Well, as you can imagine, since Hmong is really far from English, the translation is a complicated and expensive endeavor. So I'm in the process of raising the money to underwrite the translation so that then we can record it as an audiobook. And so finally, Ia will be able to read the book. And in addition to Ia, other women whose stories run parallel to hers. I can't wait for that day. That's when the book will really be done for me.
Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
That is journalist and author Lisa M. Hamilton about her new book, The Hungry Season, A Journey of War, Love, and Survival. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.